listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a Madison barbershop is also home to a men's health center. We'll hear how a new grant will help the center expand its mission to improve the health of African-American men around Dane County. First, authorities on Hawaii's Big Island are urging people to avoid the coast near the Kilauea volcano. Lava from the eruption, which began nearly 3 weeks ago, is pouring into the Pacific Ocean, generating a plume of lays that's made up of hydrochloric acid, steam, and glass particles, which can cause lung damage along with eye and skin irritation. Meanwhile, lava continues to gush out of cracks in the ground in residential areas, and clouds of volcanic ash rise thousands of feet above the Kilauea summit. 2,000 people have been evacuated from their homes. 40 structures have been burned. Lava is also getting close, apparently, to a major geothermal power plant. So what threats does the volcano pose, and how exactly do volcanoes work? Cliff Thurber is a professor of geophysics at UW-Madison. He's an expert on volcanoes and has been studying Kilauea since 1983. Cliff, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Well, you've been studying this particular volcano for a long time. How did a Wisconsin geophysicist end up so intimately connected with this Hawaii volcano?
It was actually a prior job I had working at the State University of New York at Stony Brook, and my very first NSF project was to study the summit region of Kilauea and try to determine where the magma was hiding beneath the surface.
And there's no surprise, this is an active volcano, but does this kind of activity come with any kind of warning?
Generally, yes. So in this particular case, there were earthquakes, although I haven't seen details about that, that preceded the eruption. And so they could essentially tell more or less where the eruption was headed. I think more importantly, there was deformation of the Earth's surface. You know about things like GPS, which can be used to really very carefully track how the Earth's surface is moving. And so there was a change in behavior really starting about a month before the eruption. So the people there knew something was happening.
And this is a volcano, I imagine, that's watched very closely with that kind of GPS technology we're talking about. What kind of monitoring do we do of an active volcano like this in, you know, not far from a populated area?
Right. So the first three that come to my mind, again, the so-called geodesy, so deformation observations. They use GPS instruments to tell them how the Earth is moving. They also use something called tilt meters. Basically, you can imagine that the volcano is kind of like a balloon that inflates and deflates, and the sort of sides of the balloon will start to tilt up and down as it either is, you know, rising up or falling back down. So those are very sensitive instruments. And my own area of expertise is seismology, and so, you know, studying the earthquakes that are happening are a really major clue about where magma is moving underground.
What's going on under the surface when we see on the surface these deformations and tilts and bubbles? What's going on underground that's causing that?
The ultimate source of where all this magma is coming from before it erupts and is called lava once it comes up to the surface is deep in the earth. So, you know, somewhere in the earth's mantle, so hundreds of miles deep, there's an area that's anomalously hot, and that's, you know, basically has material flowing upwards and eventually melting and working its way from the mantle into the crust of the earth and into the system where magma is stored at Kilauea. We don't really know the real details of how it's stored, you know, where exactly it is and how large it is, but, you know, we can see a change, and that's the thing we can measure, is a change in what's happening.
And Cliff, as I understand it, Hawaii is over this hot spot in the mantle, and the crust is kind of moving over that, and it's kind of good news, bad news. Good news is, because of the hot spot, we have Hawaii. That's why the islands exist. The bad news is we will still see this kind of volcanic activity. Do I have this right?
That's basically true. And what's interesting, you know, my experience and knowledge of Kilauea in particular is it kind of has these, you know, lava flows that, except for buildings, you can get out of the way of. And, you know, I don't really think of it as being explosive, but apparently, if you go back, you know, hundreds of years, it was actually much more explosive in the past, and only recently has sort of been more gentle. So that's also scary, and that's why these big explosions near the summit or at the summit haven't surprised the experts. They knew that in the past that has happened.
Talking to UW-Madison geophysics professor Cliff Thurber about this volcano in Hawaii, Kilauea, that you're seeing the dramatic images of in the news. Let's talk about some of the different things we're seeing there. Cliff, we mentioned that lays. So the lava is flowing into the Pacific Ocean. As you said, the good news is you can get out of the way of that. But it's once it hits the ocean, bad things happen. What's going on?
That's something you really have to talk to a chemist about, and I had never heard of this term lays before, but clearly what's happening is there's a chemical reaction when the lava hits the ocean water, and again, it's a little surprising to me that they're talking about hydrochloric acid being formed as part of this, and I certainly can understand tiny glass particles. If you take lava and throw it into water, it's going to turn to glass because it cools so quickly. And so those the tiny fragments end up in the air, and you can then breathe in these glass particles, which is not good for your lungs. And the prevailing winds generally flow to the west. So that means that I haven't heard about what the atmospheric conditions are, but the eruption is to the east of the summit of Kilauea, and so the winds are blowing it back towards the summit, which fortunately is not very well heavily populated. And if the winds turned around and started heading, blowing to the northeast, that would head towards Hilo, the big city, one of the big cities on the island. So that would be really bad.
Another risk is earthquakes resulting from activity around the volcano. Can you talk about the links between the two? What's going on in the volcano that's causing measurable seismic activity?
So sort of two main things going on. One is as magma moves through the crust, basically rocks are stressed and break, and that's causing small to medium-sized earthquakes, generally in the vicinity of where the magma is moving. There's also similarly smallish earthquakes happening near the summit of Kilauea, which is to the west, as it's kind of collapsing. Then there's a whole other set of earthquakes that are happening on a fault that lies underneath Kilauea volcano. And that one is sort of a mysterious, but it's been pretty well kind of mapped out. And so as the rift zone grows, as Kilauea itself grows, and this portion of Hawaii that's south of the rift zone is being pushed steadily towards the ocean, kind of like a bulldozer effect. And so there's a big fault underneath on which this chunk of Kilauea is sliding seaward. And that's where the biggest earthquakes happen, up to magnitude 7 and more.
I was out at Mount St. Helens last summer. Looks like a really peaceful scene now, but back in the 80s, I think, this huge, devastating explosion when the top of the mountain blew off affected a very wide area. Is there something about a volcano like Mount St. Helens that can make that happen that hopefully we don't have to worry about with Kilauea?
They are very different. So Kilauea, as you mentioned, is being formed by a hotspot. It's characterized as a shield volcano. Basically, that means it's sort of a very gently sloping volcano. You look at it and you say, this is a volcano, because it doesn't really look like one until you get up to the summit and you see the crater at the top. And the general explanation is that these lavas that are coming out at Kilauea are extremely hot and can flow very, very easily and flow to great distances and makes it harder to build this sort of conical-shaped feature that you associate with volcanoes like Mount St. Helens, at least before they blow their tops. So Mount Fuji, for example, is a beautiful example of a conical volcano. And so those grow in a different way. They have cooler lavas. They don't tend to have this very fluid character and be able to flow long distances. And so you end up building a steeper cone as a result.
We'll leave it there for now, Cliff. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure.
Cliff Thurber is a professor of geophysics at UW-Madison. We talked to him about the Kilauea volcano on Hawaii's Big Island. He's been studying that since 1983. First customers at JP's Hair Design in Madison can come away with more than just a haircut. The shop is also home to the Men's Health and Education Center, a place for blood pressure screenings, BMI calculations, and advice on where to seek treatment for a variety of health problems. It's part of an effort by the Rebalanced Life Wellness Association to reduce disparities in health issues between African-American men and white men in Dane County. And thanks to a new $300,000 grant, the project may soon be coming to other barbershops in the area. Aaron Perry is the founder of Rebalanced Life Wellness Association. Aaron, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thank you so much.
Also with us is Jeff Patterson, known as JP, owner of JP's Hair Design. Jeff, thanks a lot for being with us.
No problem. I'm glad to be here.
Well, Aaron, why put health centers in barbershops?
Yeah, well, you know, the focus really right now is on JP Hair Design. And so I know that there's some media that we're going to try to put one in every barbershop. That's not the direction that we're going right now. We will like to do screenings, oral screenings, blood pressure screenings in other barbershops. But the plan right now is not to put a whole men's health center
gotcha.
In another barbershop. But, you know, the barbershop has always played a significant social and cultural role in the, you know, in the black community. And when you hear the medical community say that they cannot engage black men, we knew. JP obviously has known for 20 years. And as a client of the barbershop, I realized this is where the men are at. So if you want to reach them, you have to go where they're at, and that's the barbershop.
And JP, did you think this was a natural fit when you first heard about this idea?
Yeah, Aaron was very strategic when he sat me down and talked to me about his vision. Of course, in the barbershop, you hear tons and tons of ideas, you know. And Aaron's pitch to me on the Men's Health Education Center, it was so clear. It was something that, you know, resonated in me, and it was a green light. It was something that, you know, I wanted to do. It made sense. I didn't even have space for it in the shop, but it came to fruition. It was meant to happen. We got space, and we were able to make it work.
Aaron, can you talk about some of the health challenges that African-American men are facing in Dane County, but elsewhere, too?
Yeah, primarily when you look at heart disease, if you look at, obviously, blood pressure. For instance, a good example is just last month we did 84 blood pressure screenings. And of that 84, 68% of men had high blood pressure.
Wow.
And that told us a number of things is that, you know, obviously some of the men did not have health care coverage. So we're working with them now to get Badger Care, to get them enrolled. And then the other gentlemen that did have good insurance, but haven't been to their primary care physicians, we're really working on that. But heart disease, you know, high blood pressure, diabetes, you know, we're hearing a lot of men, you know, that are diagnosed at an alarming rate with diabetes. So those are the areas that we're really focused on. Also, the tooth pain, we are doing oral screenings because we know that one of the areas that, you know, men tend to go to the ER is because of mouth pain. Hmm. And so we're really focused on our oral screenings as well.
JP, a customer comes in for a haircut. What happens then? How do they get connected with the health side of this?
Well, the Men's Health Center, it's placed in a great spot in the shop. Everybody that come in can see it. Another great thing is our clients trust us as barbers. They trust what we say. You know, we can persuade them. So it's easy to talk to our clients about just go in, get a blood pressure check. If we hear that they're having some type of issue, and we have the student nurses in or Aaron's in, we can have them go in and talk, you know, with one of the students about their issue. It changed how we talk in the shop. We talk more health now. We talk about health, you know, and how we doing. And we got it right here. We can educate people and let them know how to deal with different ailments they may have.
Aaron, JP mentioned the student nurses. Can you talk about the, you know, who's providing healthcare? Where the where are the staff coming from?
Yeah, so right now we have the Edgewood College nursing students. We have interns that come in, and they do, I believe it's about a 16 or 18-week internship with us. And they assist with screenings, data entry. We go into the community. We did a really nice blood pressure screening over at La Follette with many of the Black Student Union members. And, you know, these are some of the things that we do, not just inside of the Men's Health Center, but we try to go mobile into the community as well.
And Aaron, you mentioned, you know, people come in, they find out they have blood, high blood pressure. But what's next? You mentioned access. A lot of people don't have healthcare access, or they don't know what's out there for
them.
Right.
Yeah. And that's really kind of where we're at. I mean, we're really, when we think about the barbershops, what we want to do with Dane County is we want Dane County to be kind of the leaders nationwide as incorporating healthcare within that barbershop setting. I believe this is the model. I believe it's the new healthcare model, and we're hopeful that basically the way I look at it, time is up. Time is up for everyone that's been out here attempting to make a difference, but have, you know, I don't want to say failed, but maybe haven't been creative enough. And that is really what we are trying to do, get the health care in the hands of the men that need it the most.
Talking to Aaron Perry, founder of Rebalanced Life Wellness Association, and Jeff Patterson, also known as JP, owner of JP's Hair Design, about this project, bringing health care into the barbershop, trying to address health disparities for African-American men. JP, you mentioned this is changing the conversation. So what are people talking about now when they talk about their health and well-being?
Well, a lot of times the blood pressure come up, because that's something that can be done real quick. It's not an invasive, you know, they go right into the Men's Health Education Center and get checked. They know their reading. They know where they're at. You know, if their blood pressure is high or if it's good or low. So that, you hear a lot about the blood pressure check. We've had people come in, Aaron talked about it earlier, about having tooth pain and mouth pain. With the oral screenings, you know, we've been able to direct them to a dentist, so, you know, they can get some help with their tooth issue. But it's just been and another thing that people talk about is weight loss now. Yes. You know, staying healthy, eating right, and working out. So I think the conversation's changed. We've had some challenges among the barbers as far as losing weight and going to work out. So it's a good thing. It's moving towards the right direction.
Mm-hmm. Aaron, is that part of the, I guess, counseling or advice people are getting, not just maybe blood pressure medication, but information about exercise, nutrition options?
Absolutely. You know, whatever it takes for us to move that needle in the health disparities. One of the things that we did with the Edgewood College nursing students is we actually did taught all of the barbers how to do blood pressure screenings. And because JP has a very unique, business, and that it's by appointment only, and that so that time is very limited. So having the barbers to be able to do blood pressure screenings, we purchased the wrist blood pressure cuff. So basically, while the barbers are cutting hair, we can actually do a screening right at the same time. And so these are kind of the things that we're getting really creative about, and it's really making a difference for the men that don't have a lot of time.
JP, when you went into being a barber, did you ever think you'd be learning to do blood pressure screenings along the way?
No. I've been amazed on how much exposure we've gotten and how we've helped people, you know, with this health education initiative that Aaron partnered up with us at the shop with. It's been awesome.
Do you ever get, you know, pushback, JP, people like, hey, I'm just here for a haircut, I don't want to talk about my health?
Yeah, of course, that happens. Okay. And the thing is, it happens, and next thing you know, maybe visit number 5 or visit number 6, they end up in the Men's Health Education Center. Mm-hmm. So sometimes, you know, take, you know, a couple times to ask or for them to see and know that this is, you know, something that can help them. So, no, they don't buy in all the time at the first pitch, but eventually, you know, they pop in and say hi to Aaron or get their blood pressure checked. So they know if they need something, they can come right to the barbershop where they trust, you know, the people here and get education on health and get blood pressure checked. So it's here for them. You know, they may not go in a day, but They may go in tomorrow.
We'll get them.
And Aaron, what are some of your next steps now that you've had some success here?
Yeah, so what we're looking at is creating a barbershop health advisory committee, and that is getting all of the 8 barbershop owners together, and we'll be meeting once a month. And so far we have about 3 or 4 just pretty much committed. And we know that the others have some strong interests. But what we'll do with that meeting, it's getting everyone together so we can have one voice, you know, one mission and one voice throughout the county, so that when we talk about different health challenges, it can be a consistent message throughout all of the barbershops.
JP, do you think that your customers are keeping this with them when they leave your barbershop? They're going out and talking about it maybe with friends and family.
Yeah, I know it's life-changing for some of the guys. Yeah, they talk about it, and the thing is, you know, a lot of the guys come in every 2 weeks. Some come in once a week. Some come in every 3 weeks. So it's constantly, they're constantly seeing it. They're constantly, you know, getting reminded about, you know, staying educated on their health. So, I mean, it's in front of them at all times. And once again, they trust what we say as barbers. So long as we preaching the right message, you know, it'll resonate with our clients.
Aaron, are you getting people coming to you and wanting to steal your idea in a good way, saying, hey, maybe there's other, maybe for different groups of people, maybe it's not the barbershop, it's something else, but we like this model?
Yeah, well, me and JP got pretty much, we're getting that wrapped up because, you know, we anticipate that. But the reality is that we were the first out the gate with this concept, and we're really looking forward to, you know, bringing this nationwide. We believe we have the model here.
And JP, you know, you've got a lot of returning customers. I'm guessing they're helping spread the word.
Yeah, they are. They're definitely buying into the Men Health Education Center. And one thing, JP heard is that we've been open 20 years. You know, we're celebrating our 20 year anniversary. May 1st was 20 years. So we're a pillar in the community. You know, people believe in us. They trust us. So. I believe what we do here at JP Hair Design carries a lot of weight. So I'm proud of that. I got a great team of barbers, a great partnership in Aaron with the Men Health Education Center.
And we'll have to leave it there. Thanks to JP and Aaron. We've been talking to Aaron Perry, founder of the Rebalanced Life Wellness Association. Also with us, Jeff Patterson, also known as JP, owner of JP's Hair Design. This is Central Time. First, more than 100 former football players have filed lawsuits against the National Collegiate Athletic Association, the NCAA, for head injuries sustained while playing the sport in college. Many of the lawsuits outline severe and debilitating physical and mental health issues, including headaches, depression, and mobility problems. At their most severe, some lawsuits chronicle suicides associated with repeated traumatic head injuries brought about by the contact sport. A former Badger linebacker is one of the latest to challenge the NCAA in court and is one of a growing number of former players raising awareness about the dangers associated with the game. Luke Schetzel is a freelance reporter and contributor to the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. His most recent piece for the WCIJ profiles Tony Megna and his lawsuit against the NCAA. Luke, welcome back to Central Time.
It's great to be back.
Luke, tell us what first drew you to this story.
So I originally wrote an earlier story about how current student athletes, all of them college football players for the Wisconsin Badgers, were kind of, you know, either willingly downplaying concerns or they were ignorant of the concerns surrounding head trauma and brain injuries in football. And that story led me to Tony Megna's attorneys reaching out to me and wanting his story to be told, and then interviewing him, and then going down to his, he actually owns a medical facility, a non-traditional medical facility in the Racine area. And we did a video shoot as well, so a couple interviews with him.
Mm-hmm. And let's talk about Tony's story. Apart from the injuries, it might look like a heartwarming human interest story. Walk-on, mm-hmm. right, mm-hmm. for UW,
yeah,
made the
classic
team.
Classic tradition here in Wisconsin, the walk-on tradition. Mm-hmm.
Talk about his story and the injuries that he experienced.
Yeah, so he, you know, came in as a walk-on and knew, in his words, that he had to play beyond himself to kind of prove himself that he was, you know, should be there, should be on the field, should be getting playing time. And, you know, he played alongside on the scout team originally, alongside some of the greats here in Wisconsin. J.J. Watt, who's probably the best player to ever come out of this school. You know, he played right alongside him, played just as well as him on the scout team, actually, before J.J. progressed into the player he became. And then ended up coming back for a while to play behind Chris Borland as Chris Borland's backup. Chris Borland, of course, ended up leaving football due to concerns about head trauma. But then Tony started to, you know, there was never really a set hit that caused it, but he's woke up one morning and just had these debilitating headaches. And, you know, they'd be dull throughout the day. They'd never go away, but they'd be about a 3 out of 10 throughout the whole day. But then, you know, they'd pierce and spike, in his own words, multiple dozens times a day, and they'd be a 10 or even an 11, just unbearable to deal with, you know, puking in practice because he was so nauseous because of the headaches. And he could just never find answers.
Want to listen to Tony. This is him in an interview with WCIJ.
There was a constant dull headache that was just always kind of throbbing in my head. And then throughout the day, it would pierce and spike as if somebody was kind of twisting my eye a little bit. And then also additional symptoms of memory loss, of nausea and vertigo. And it just began to progress and kind of spiral. My health began to spiral downward.
One concern in these lawsuits is how the NCAA, how conferences, how university sports programs communicated risks and dealt with these problems they're reported. Can you talk about how Tony Megna dealt with these symptoms as a player, how the team doctors dealt with these symptoms?
Right. They, in Tony's words, you know, they always looked to address the symptoms he was, you know, the pain he was feeling, not necessarily what was causing the pain. And they obviously looked for answers as well. At one point, they thought he might have a brain tumor, which, I mean, I can't even imagine having to worry about that. And then also they thought he might have Lyme's disease as well. And just going through a litany of possibilities, but none of them, according to Tony, ever said, oh, it's because, you know, you're practicing and getting hit in the head, you know, 100 times a practice or 100 times a week. So none of them ever pointed to the head trauma, and that he didn't come to that conclusion until well after he had left the program.
Talking to Luke Schetzel about a piece he wrote for the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism, a lot of lawsuits being filed by former college football players against the NCAA related to head injuries and their long-term impact. A former Badger linebacker now joining their numbers, Tony Megna. Luke, a central claim of a lot of these lawsuits is that the university, as I was saying earlier, universities, the NCAA, the sports programs, didn't communicate the risk. Can you talk about what Tony's lawsuit specifically is saying about his experience?
Right. He's not currently in a lawsuit per se. He's planning on filing one. But the central claim is that the education the players receive, which now ever since 2010, the NCAA has mandated a concussion management plan, which only mandates that a school have a program. There's no centralized protocol yet, but each school has to have one, and schools do their own versions, or conferences do their own versions of educating these players on head injuries. And currently, though, it's, you know, these fact sheets or these presentations that just talk about symptoms, and, you know, you need to report it. You don't want a second concussion when you have a concussion that could lead to death, long-term consequences. But none of them you know, talk about the potential accumulation of the impacts, and they mention long-term effects, but they don't really explicitly say, you know, CTE, dementia, Parkinson's, memory loss. They don't really spell it out as much as these former players think that they should have. And before 2010, this wasn't mandated at all.
What does Tony say about his health since he left the program?
Told me, you know, especially directly after, you know, he was in a dark place, you know, depressive episodes, suicidal thoughts, a lot of the common symptoms of not just trauma associated with CTE, but just trauma itself. But then he was introduced through, you know, Eastern medicine, non-traditional medicine, acupuncture, oxygen deprivation chambers, non-traditional ways to treat issues. He found out that it was probably due to the head impacts, and probably through news coverage of CTE and head impacts in football, he came to that conclusion, and he actually studied it and became a medical practitioner himself, and now he owns a clinic down in Racine.
And he, before he got to this point, I think you wrote that he had spent a good amount of money actually in Western mm-hmm. medicine trying to diagnose what was going on with him.
Yeah, tens of thousands of dollars, which is what kind of these lawsuits, you know, their goal is to make systematic change in the NCAA, in what the NCAA would call itself amateur sports, so that these student athletes are protected in what they would consider a proper way. And then also to recover, you know, maybe lost wages because they haven't been able to keep work because, you know, they can't focus or memory loss or medical expenses.
Last time we talked to you about it, that other piece you mm-hmm. had referenced, there's a powerful incentive for the player, maybe even if they do know the risks, to downplay them. They love the game. They right. want to be on the field. Maybe their scholarship is at risk if they can't stay on the team, they can't stay on the field. There's a lot of reasons why the players themselves might not pursue the healthiest option.
Right, and yeah, the first article when we talked last time, you know, it was a varying degrees of either players who were just didn't have the knowledge they should have about concussions, which is worrisome, and the fact that they just didn't know. But then there were others who, yeah, you know, the damage that's done is done already. I'm going to keep going because I could make millions of dollars doing this for a living. So it's varying degrees of either not knowing or knowing and accepting that risk.
A question I think a lot of parents have, mm-hmm. maybe younger players who are seeing this news, I don't know, is should we be playing football at all? Tony, looking back, what did he say? Did he regret having played the game?
Right. And it was kind of, I asked him that question a few times, and it was always surprising to hear him say, you know, he doesn't regret it at all. He doesn't regret coming here, doesn't regret trying to keep playing. Because in his eyes, he wouldn't be where he is now with his medical practice without having have gone through those experiences. So it's kind of a silver linings outlook there. And, you know, he still feels like the life lessons he learned playing football were as valuable as he thought of them back then as well.
And is he and players like him calling for changes to the game, the way concussions are managed?
Yeah, he believes that now after going through graduate school and learning more about medicine, he believes that, you know, they need to be more proactive. It's not just sit out for a while and then come back. It's, you know, proactively, even before the injury, you know, massage the scalp, do acupuncture, you know, do these stretches and do all these type of medical treatments even before there's an injury so that it can help prevent. In his words, it's getting the body ready for impact, kind of, which is what he believes the NCAA and even the NFL are lacking completely.
Talking to Luke Schetzel, he's a freelance reporter, contributor to the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. He's with us to talk about his latest piece for the center, which profiles former UW-Madison linebacker Tony Megna, how he's planning to file a lawsuit against the NCAA for head injuries he received while playing college football. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the NCAA, about college football, and this growing number of head injury complaints, growing number of players filing lawsuits against the organization? If you played high school or college football, what was your experience? Would you do it again after what you've seen in the news about head injuries? Do you let your kid play football? Do you think enough care is taken when it comes to head injuries? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we continue the conversation about the lawsuits being brought against the NCAA by former college football players over head injuries they received while playing the sport. A former Badger linebacker is planning on filing a similar suit against the NCAA, says he's suffered debilitating headaches and other issues allegedly brought on by playing college football. Luke Schetzel is with us, freelance reporter, contributor to the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. He recently wrote about this lawsuit and the wider issues surrounding it. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about these lawsuits filed by NCAA college football players against the organization? Do you support them? If you were a football player in college, we want to hear about your experience. Did you have these head injuries? Do you feel a long-term impact from them, do you think? And would you let your kids play the game? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll go to your calls now. John is with us in Waukesha. John, hi.
Hi, Hi. I was calling. I played football since sixth grade until high school. I did not play into college, unfortunately, but I just didn't realize that people, I guess, didn't realize hitting your head was bad for you. I thought people understood these risks, and I just would like to know, like, why people didn't understand hitting your head was bad for you.
John, thanks for the call. I mean, I think we all get that getting hit in the head was bad for us. Can you talk about some of the latest science and whether or not college football players were aware of the long-term impacts, Luke?
Right, yeah. The first story I wrote, it was spurred off of the whole reason I got started on the story was Harvard and Boston had just come out with a new study showing that, 99% of the brains they had looked at of former NFL players had CTE. So it was just wondering if the players were, one, aware of it, and two, if they cared. And most of the ones I talked to were just not aware of the current events going on. So, yeah, obviously a lot of them did know, most likely, that because I, don't want to generalize for all of them. But, I think a lot of them do understand that, banging your head, getting a concussion isn't good. But I don't think they necessarily understood the long-term effects. They understood that, yeah, in the short term, I'm going to miss a game or I'm going to miss a week of practice, but not that, I might miss the last 20 years of my life because I'm going to have a debilitating brain injury.
And one of the concerns here is that it can be more subtle than that concussion and the repetitive actual diagnosable concussion, this idea that the head impact, even if they don't reach the concussion level, you're right, it's the equivalent of having, a couple traffic accidents a game sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's the accumulation of subconcussive hits. When I interviewed Dr. Bennett Amalu, the doctor who discovered and named CTE, he, said that every time the brain takes a hit, it doesn't go away. It doesn't heal itself. The brain doesn't have a capacity to heal itself. So every small hit is accumulated upon each other. And they just showed a new study. I'm not sure exactly where it came out of. I think it was Boston University again. Showed that you don't have to have ever had a real concussion to get CTE. So it is that accumulation.
John, thanks for that call. We'll go next to Brad with us in Eau Claire. Brad, hi.
Hi. One reason I'm calling is our family has kind of a personal interest in this because the movie Concussion about Mike Webster actually is my wife's cousin. And to add to that, when I played football in high school, we were never allowed to tackle above the waist. If we tackled above the waist, that was considered a bad tackle. The other thing is we never used our head as a weapon, and I can't understand why they haven't put a stop to using the head as a weapon when they're tackling, either in high school football. I think it's more prevalent, though, in professional football and college football. But we never led with our head, and I don't think any helmet would protect your brain from hits like that.
Brad, thanks for the call. There have been changes in the rules, helmet-to-helmet hits in particular, that used to be highlight reel stuff are now treated as devastatingly horrible, I think, in a lot of ways, which is a good change.
Right.
What are you seeing in terms of rule changes? Are there things that have changed? Are there things that people are talking about?
I think, especially the targeting rule in college football. It basically ejects a defensive player from a game if they lead with their head. And that it's gotten a lot of blowback from fans who are fans of quote unquote traditional rough and tough football, but it's seemingly had a positive effect on bringing down the number of head to head hits. But also there's rule changes, in the NFL, especially where they've made rule changes to protect, to address the, last caller's comments about, a good tackle is below the waist, is what he experienced back in the day. But now they want to protect players' legs, especially quarterbacks, because of knee injuries that are becoming a major issue. So then defensive players are forced to hit above the waist. So that, I think, could have a possible negative impact on the number of head impacts.
And I know one of the concerns isn't the tackling necessarily. It's the beginning of every play when the offensive line, really big guys,
down
and
the
defensive
trenches,
line, big guys, or the linebackers, like Tony, who we were talking about earlier, crash into each other, a lot of mass and velocity coming together there.
Yeah, down in the trenches. And that's where a lot of these subconcussive hits happen. You're never going to get an offensive lineman who is running 10 yards downfield, hitting a defensive lineman 10 yards downfield. So they're not going full speed. It's the they're standing up as fast as they can and ramming each other, trying to gain leverage. So that's where a lot of those sub-concussive hits happen. So that's where you don't see a lot of diagnosed concussions with offensive or defensive linemen, but you see a lot of the sub-concussive data come from linemen.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Luke Schetzel about a piece he wrote for the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism on lawsuits filed or being filed by former college football players, a UW-Madison former linebacker planning on joining that list. Back to your calls now. Charlie is on the line in Milwaukee. Charlie, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My question for your guest is, for these lawsuits, are we sure that it is only the trauma involved in football? Or how do they take out, say, alcohol or drugs or even steroids from chemically contributing to the or potentiating the CTE that they're seeing in the football players?
Charlie, thanks a lot for the call. There's a lot of research out there. Does the research try to tease out, okay, this is right. impact from football versus these other factors that Charlie brought up?
I think one of the – when you talk to the current researchers of CTE, of head impacts, of concussion, subconcussive hits, a lot of it is that we just don't have a wide base of natural knowledge of the injury, of head injury in general. So I think that's one area they're trying to really just expand the database of knowledge we have on the issue. But also, you know, there's a lot of data on youth football players, players who never got beyond playing high school or even youth football that have CTE and concussion problems. So I think that sometimes should tease that kind of stuff out. But I'm not totally sure exactly on how the research would tease that stuff out.
Thanks a lot for that call, Charlie. We'll go next to Kevin in Janesville. Kevin, hi.
Hi. Just wondering, what kind of data might be out there? Is there research on other impact sports that are not as heavily padded and helmeted like rugby? Are we seeing the same long-term collision effects in sports where the athletes are not dressed like tanks?
Kevin, thanks for that call. I don't know if you've looked into that, Luke.
I haven't looked into that a lot, but I do know one of rugby's issues is skull fractures, which used to be a problem in football back before they had, you know, the normal, you know, helmets we see now. So helmets weren't designed to stop, you know, brain trauma. They were designed to stop skull fractures. So rugby, you might not see as many concussions, but you're going to see more skull fractures. That's the extent of the knowledge I have, though, on rugby. And I do know researchers aren't sure on other non-football sports unless, quote-unquote, American sports. Soccer, researchers aren't sure. Soccer actually might have a higher incidence of concussion and subconcussive hits based on heading the ball, just running into each other, falling down, and stuff like that. So there's a lot of studying to be done yet, for sure.
And briefly, Luke, do we have any kind of timeline on all these lawsuits, all these people filing lawsuits against the NCAA? Anything going to happen soon on that?
So all of these lawsuits are in the pre-trial stage at the moment. The NCAA has filed motions to dismiss on claims of either a statute of limitations running out, jurisdictional claims, or claims that there isn't a argument being brought forth that can be provided relief by the NCAA. And the timeline is anywhere in 2019 or 2020. It's a really long process, especially when you're dealing with as many lawsuits as the NCAA is dealing with.
Luke, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Luke Schetzel, a freelance reporter and contributor to the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. He talked to us about his recent piece looking at a former Badger linebacker, Tony Megna, who's planning on filing a lawsuit against the NCAA, joining a lot of other lawsuits, over 100 so far, over head injuries related to the game.